preparation for that time, I thought I would lead you in a brief study in one of the servant songs in the book of Isaiah. And so I would ask you to turn to the 42nd chapter of Isaiah, the first of these songs, for just some brief comments. Isaiah 42. As most of you know, the book of Isaiah is divided into three parts. I think you would see that almost immediately if you read through the book. The first section, chapters 1 through 35, deals with Isaiah's times. He's speaking to his contemporaries, the people of his time in those chapters. It's set against the backdrop of the Assyrian period. Though the nation is powerful, wealthy, and influential, it's a time when the nation of Judah is spiritually decadent. And Isaiah speaks into these times, talks about the injustice of that period. And though God looks for righteousness and injustice, what he sees is a cry. It is a cry of the oppressed. And Isaiah predicts that judgment is coming. He will whistle, to use Isaiah's term, for Assyria. And the Assyrians would be the rod that God uses to chasten the people of God. In those opening chapters, Isaiah speaks very specifically about the problems that exist in the nation and about the judgment that's coming. The second section of Isaiah, chapters 36 through 39, are a sort of historical bridge between the first and third sections, and introduce us to one of the causes, at least, of the Babylonian captivity. Because in the third section, chapters 40 through 66, Isaiah speaks about the Babylonian captivity at least 130 years after his time. He predicts its coming, tells them what it will be like, predicts the regathering to the land, the rebuilding of the temple, and the restoration of the nation in Judah. If the theme of the first 35 chapters is condemnation, the theme of these final chapters is comfort. He prepares them for the exile well in advance of that act of God, and he comforts them in advance. It's so much like the Lord to prepare us for times of trial and announce comfort even before we enter into those periods, and this is what he does through Isaiah. And in these closing chapters, from chapters 40 through 66, he talks about one who's designated as the servant of the Lord. It's the servant who will effect salvation. He's the one who will, through whom God will accomplish his purposes in the nation. And he's very much in the center of Isaiah's thinking, particularly in the section from 40 through 53. The section we have in front of us is the first of these references to the servant of the Lord. Now, just to give you a brief introduction to chapter 42, chapter 41 is a court scene. God calls all the nations, the Gentile nations, to stand before the bar of judgment. God is the judge and the prosecuting attorney and the jury, and he asks them to present their case. He brings together two classes of Gentiles. There are the Gentiles off to the east, that is the Gentiles from Mesopotamia, and the Gentiles to the west, those that are dwelling around the Mediterranean Sea, on the Mediterranean coast. And the issue in this court scene is who can bring about justice in the world, who can effect justice, who can set things right. He calls on the nations to present their case, and then he presents his case. He describes his mighty acts in history and how he's going to effect salvation, and then he calls upon them to present their case. How will you set things right? And we have to remember that when Isaiah was writing, there were a number of large empires that were either in the process of being built or were established. The Assyrian Empire, the Babylonian Empire, were established during this time. The city of Rome was founded shortly after Isaiah's time. This was the classical period of Greece, their golden age. And he calls on them to answer to give a solution to the problems that face mankind. How can we heal a broken and struggling and suffering humanity? And they have nothing to say. These are the great thinkers of their age, the people upon which most of our Western thought is based. And they have no answer. In verses 28 and 29 of chapter 41, in those verses, God gives his verdict. But when I look, that is, at the nations, there is no one, and there is no counselor among them. There is no one who can give good counsel, who can lead mankind out of his circumstances. Who, if I ask, can give an answer? Behold, all of them are false. Their works are worthless. Their molten images are wind and emptiness. They have nothing to say. But then another figure is introduced into the courtroom, and he's the servant of the Lord. First, he calls on us in verse 29 to behold the nations, both representatives from the east and from the west. And then in chapter 42, verse 1, he calls on us to behold the servant, and he fixes our attention on the one who's designated here as his servant. And that, of course, is always the answer to man's problem, fixing our eyes on the servant of the Lord and getting our eyes off of the thoughts and the philosophy and the attempts to come to terms with life that are alternatives to the solution that the servant poses. Now, the question, of course, is who is the servant? And it seems very clear that in this particular passage, the servant is the Lord Jesus. The Jews recognized, long before Jesus' time, that this was a reference to Messiah. In almost all of their ancient translations of this section, translations from Hebrew and Aramaic, they insert between the third and fourth words of verse 1, the word Messiah. Behold my servant, Messiah. So the Jews knew, before Jesus came, to whom this verse referred. And Matthew, speaking as an inspired apostle, applies these words directly to the Lord. So for those of us who believe the Scriptures, there's no question, the servant of the Lord here is the Lord Jesus. And we're called upon to look at him as the solution to every problem. Now let's see how he's described. Behold my servant whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nations. He will not cry out or raise his voice nor make his voice heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break, and a dimly burning wick he will not extinguish. He will faithfully bring forth justice. He will not be disheartened or crushed until he has established justice on the earth. And the coastlands will wait expectantly for his law. Now you'll recognize immediately that the theme of this section is justice. Three times in 12 lines, he says, this one, the servant of the Lord, will bring forth justice. In other words, this is the one that will set things right, because that's what the term justice means. He will establish things as they ought to be. There are two terms that occur frequently in the Old Testament, and they're often found in conjunction with one another, the terms righteousness and the terms justice. The word righteousness in the Old Testament means to bring a thing into conformity with a standard or a norm. In other words, they would talk about righteous measurements, righteous weights, as weights that were accurate. They conformed to a norm, to a standard. In the Old Testament, they describe evergreen trees as trees of righteousness, because they always looked as a tree ought to look. They didn't drop their leaves during the winter. So they were righteous trees. The term basically means to bring something into conformity with what it ought to be, to establish it according to the right standard. And in the Old Testament, the standard is the character of God. So righteousness means bringing something into conformity to the character of God. Justice is the outworking of righteousness. Justice is the application of righteousness. It's the action by which the king or some other person, brings about a state of righteousness in the nation. So it's the practical application of righteousness. So when Isaiah says the servant of the Lord will bring about justice in the world, he's saying that he will establish things according to a right standard. Things will be as they ought to be. Whether we're talking about our homes, or society, or ourselves, getting ourselves aligned with God's standard, it's the servant of the Lord who will accomplish that. And he's the only one who can. No one else can. There's no alternative to the servant of the Lord. Now, in this section, we're told something of the resources that empowered the servant. And then we're told something of his manner or his demeanor. And then finally, a word about his persistence. First, the resources that enabled him to bring about justice in the earth. He's described as the servant whom the Father upholds. If you look in the side margin, you'll note that the term means to take hold of something. It means to strengthen someone by taking a grip on them. And that's what the Father does for the servant, the Lord Jesus. The Lord Jesus derived his strength from the Father. Now that's an unusual thought for us because we normally think of the Lord, since he was God, as self-sufficient. He was sufficient in himself. And yet the Lord himself tells us that his strength was derived from the Father. He wasn't strong in himself. He experienced all of the weakness and the limitations of the flesh apart from sin. Therefore, he understands our limitations. He himself had to depend upon the Father for his strength. There was simply no other way that he could carry out the ministry that the Father had given to him. Now, in contrast to that, the representatives of both the Eastern and the Western worlds say in chapter 41, when they're under stress, let's strengthen one another. Turn back to chapter 41. And in verse 5, we read the coastlands, this is a reference to the Western Gentile powers, those settled around the Mediterranean Sea, the Romans, the Greeks, the Egyptians. The coastlands have seen and are afraid. The ends of the earth tremble. They have drawn near and have come. Each one helps his neighbor and says to his brother, be strong. Now that's the term that's found in chapter 42, where it said that the Lord strengthens or upholds or take holds of the servant. All of Eastern and Western philosophy is shot through with the idea that the way to handle crises, in this case it was an invasion from the east, the invasion of Cyrus, when a crisis like this appears, you help one another by saying, be strong. Haven't you heard that before? Try again. Try a little harder. Take a grip on yourself. When the going gets tough, then the tough get going. And so you just, that's the way we encourage one another. You have a hard day tomorrow, just be strong. Instead of being strengthened by the Lord. I saw a peanut strip last week. Charlie Brown goes for counseling to Lucy, and she's sitting in her booth with her banner, psychiatry, 5 cents. And Charlie Brown says, Lucy, you know I've tried. Tell me I've tried. I've tried, and I've tried, and I've tried to be good. And Lucy says, nice try, Charlie Brown. 5 cents. Well, what a release to know that we can stop trying. And we can begin to trust in the strength of an indwelling Lord. That's what sustained the Lord Jesus. If he required that sort of strengthening from the Father, how much more do we? Now, that's the first step. The servant was upheld by the Father. And secondly, we're told that he is the Father's chosen one who delights the Father. My chosen one in whom my soul delights. He's choice, and beloved of the Father. He's a delight to the Father. I have three sons, and they all are a great delight to me. So I can understand. This was a son that the Father loved and had especially chosen. These are the words that were addressed to the son at his baptism. This is my beloved son, in whom I am well pleased. Long before the Lord Jesus ever did a thing, before he ever worked a miracle, before he ever taught, before he engaged in any ministry at all, he was assured of the love and the approval and the delight of the Father. And that's what enabled him to undergo the lack of delight on the part of men. People weren't delighted with him. But he could persevere in what he was doing because he was assured of the acceptance and the love of the Father. And of course, the same is true of us. We're not always going to receive the praise and appreciation of people. They won't always understand. We won't delight them. But we, like the Son, are chosen and a source of delight to him. And thirdly, we're told that he possesses the Spirit. I have put my Spirit upon him. In the Old Testament, the Spirit is the principle that gets things done. It's the animating principle. It's God at work. It is God. It's more than a principle. It's also a person. But it's described in terms that they can understand. It's like the wind. The same term is translated wind throughout the Old Testament, or breath is translated Spirit. They'd seen the wind at work, though they couldn't see the wind. And this is the way the ministry of the Son is described. He possesses the Spirit. The Spirit empowers him. Everywhere he went, the wind blew. He could affect people's lives powerfully and change attitudes and have great impact upon people because he possessed the Spirit. Now, these were the characteristics of the Son. This was the power that he drew upon to carry out his ministry. And the last line of verse 1 tells us that because of the resources that he possessed in the Father, he will bring forth justice to the nations. He will set things right. The second thing we're told about the servant is that he will not cry out or raise his voice or make his voice heard in the street. He wouldn't demand recognition. He didn't publish daily reports to the Jerusalem Post. He didn't talk about what he did, nor did he tell people necessarily how he did it. He just went about doing what the Father had called him to do. Didn't promote himself. He quietly followed the will of his Father. And then we're told in verse 3 that he will not break a bruised reed, and a dimly burning wick he will not extinguish. That's a description of the nature of his ministry and the sort of people that he was drawn to, the kind of lives that were most attractive to him. Somehow we've fallen into the mistake of thinking that God is only pleased with the strong, with those who have everything thought through spiritually, who've handled all their problems, who don't struggle any longer, those who are in positions of leadership, who appear to have everything together. Those are the people that God is pleased with. But he's sort of put off by the rest of us because we're struggling and weak. And this passage puts the lie to that thought, because it's the broken and the bruised and the nearly extinguished that God ministers to. This is a very graphic picture. I can see in my mind a slender reed, crushed, half broken, bending over, or a little lamp with a piece of flax in it, nearly extinguished, merely a glowing ember, and the Lord props up the broken reed, and he fans into flame the smoking flax. That's what he was called to do. He came, he said, as a physician to the sick. Those were the people that he was drawn to. Those were the ones that he ministered to. We're fortunate here in our family to have a very fine heart surgeon. And one thing I've noticed about Ed in my contacts with him. He never asked me about the state of my heart. Last time we talked, he asked me how my beard was growing, but he didn't say a thing about my heart. He's not preoccupied with my heart. He doesn't call me up every day to ask if it's still plugging along. But when he meets someone who has a troubled heart, that's when he goes into action. All of his compassion and the skill in his mind and in his hands is brought to bear on healing that troubled heart. That's what attracts him. And see, if the truth is known, all of us have troubled hearts. All of us are broken reeds. Despite the front that we erect, we're smoking flaxes. And that's what draws the Lord to our aid. He wants to minister to us. Fan us back into flame. Prop us back up. Strengthen us and encourage us. And that, of course, is the ministry that we're called to as well. To seek out the weak and the floundering and the struggling and minister to them. And by so doing, Isaiah tells us again, he will faithfully bring forth justice. And then this final word in verse 4, he will not be disheartened or crushed until he has established justice in the earth. And the coastlands will wait expectantly for his law. The term that's translated disheartened here in this passage is the same word that's found in the second line of verse 3, a dimly burning wick. It's that term. The term translated crushed is the word that's translated bruised in the first verse of line 3. The point being, though he ministers to the bruised and to the crushed, he himself is never bruised nor crushed. He doesn't catch the disease. He doesn't give up. He doesn't get faint-hearted. He doesn't say to me and to you, one more time, and I'm not available. One more time, and I won't forgive. How many times have we said, Lord, here I am back again doing the same thing. Can you ever forgive me? Certainly he can. He never gives up. He persists until he will bring about justice. Now, that's the ministry that was given to the servant. He was one submissive to the will of the Father. And that's the one that ministers to us and to our needs. He had from the Father all the resources necessary to bring about justice, to set things right. And he set about doing it quietly, without any fanfare, without drawing a large following, certainly not at the end of his ministry. But he quietly and patiently ministered to the weak, to the lowly, to the oppressed, to the downtrodden. And though it appeared throughout his lifetime that his efforts would be fruitless, he established justice. He laid down the basis for a righteous and just society. And that, of course, is the pattern for our life as well. He not only accomplished what he set out to do, he gave us the example. And he's the one who's called us to the same ministry. Well, I'd just like to encourage you with those words. I think Paul had them in mind when he wrote in 2 Timothy, the servant of the Lord must not strive, but be patient with all men, gentle, in meekness, instructing those that oppose themselves. That was the Lord's ministry, and that's our ministry as well. So if you're here this morning and you feel like a broken and bruised reed, and your flax is about to go out, remember, it's the servant of the Lord that you need to behold.